It's a great pleasure for the Poetry Center to welcome James Wright to this campus again. I'm not quite sure how most of you know James Wright's work, and in many ways an introduction is unnecessary, but I want to do an introduction anyway. In his last book, which is called The Branch Will Not Break, the following poem occurs, and it's the second of two hangovers. In a pine tree, I have his permission to read this to you. In a pine tree, a few yards away from my windowsill, a brilliant blue jay is springing up and down on a branch. I laugh as I see him abandon himself to entire delight, for he knows as well as I do that the branch will not break. The poem seems to me to express directly and economically an attitude toward poetry, a whole sense of poetry, and a whole sense of poetic possibility that Jim Wright represents. He seems to me one of the most important poets in the country, and certainly in the forefront of what has been called a lyric or romantic revival. And this is, I find the lyric revival matter for great self-congratulation. The poetry that I was brought up on was a poetry determined to a great extent by the attitudes of the New Criticism. And the New Criticism encouraged a kind of poetry in which the terms of the poem were interested pretty much in each other, and not in the poet. The poet was really supposed to use the poem as a kind of escape from his own personality. And there was very little pressure on the poem to communicate anything to any reader. The poem was intended to be a kind of dissociated aesthetic object which lent itself to academic analysis. We are happily free of that attitude now, and I think one of the voices that have freed us from that attitude is the voice of James Wright. He was born in Martins Ferry, Ohio. He's presently a member of the English department at Hunter College in New York. His first book was The Green Wall, published in 1957, and St. Judas in 1959. The great change took place in his work between that book and The Branch Will Not Break. A forthcoming book, the next book, will appear in the fall. From the few poems in that book that I've seen, it seems to me that James Wright is getting closer and closer to his own center. It seems to me a collection which will contain poems that give voice to a kind of central mute source. It's a great pleasure to give you James Wright.
Thank you, Mark. You can all hear me, can't you? What a stupid question that is. I never remember how stupid it is until I I actually ask it. If people can't hear you, then how can they know how to answer the question? Even as a stock response. Maybe there's another way to get around it. You can all hear me. Oh. (clears throat) I would like to begin by reading an old poem of my own. Just because it's old. This is a sonnet, and it was written many years ago, and I tried to make it very as formally accurate as I could, because I care about poetry, which is passionately formal and very traditional. The strange thing about these poems that are tried very hard to be formal and regular is that they started to call up a kind of darkness. Maybe that had to be handled in another way. It's a sonnet, and as I say, it's very regular. Someone said it sounded, you know, very thumping and regular, like Edwin Markham. Never thought of that. Edwin Markham. Well, all right. It's called To a Fugitive. The night you got away, I dreamed you rose out of the earth to lean on a young tree. Then they were there, hulking the moon away, the great dogs rooting, snuffing up the grass. You raise a hand, hungry to hold your lips, out of the wailing air, but lights begin spidering the ground. Oh, they come closing in. The beam searches your face like fingertips. Hurry, McGuire. Hammer the body down, crouch to the wall again, shackle the cold machine guns and the sheriff and the cars, divide the bright bars of the cornered bone, strip, run for it, break the last law, unfold, dart down the alley, race between the stars. A regular poem. I don't know that it came off even as a formal poem. Formal, I mean externally formal, I suppose. I would like to read some poems out of my last book, which is called The Branch Will Not Break. And then after I read some of them, I would like to read several out of my new manuscript. Now, the first of these poems out of the book, The Branch, has a long title. I suppose this is partly the influence of Arthur Whaley. At a certain point in my life, I found out that there is a literature in the world which is very beautiful and very intelligent, and it isn't English, and it isn't American, it isn't European. It's Oriental. That sounds like Mark Twain's remark about something. Something. This is un-American. It is un-American. It is un-English. It is French. No, but I found out about Arthur Whaley. I hadn't realized really that he existed, or I hadn't paid any attention to him. Maybe I had to study for a while or reach a certain age. I don't know. Envy I have. Envy for a certain possibility that many young poets have available to them is that their awareness of the great Oriental literature. A poet like Gary Snyder, who is to my mind an extremely beautiful poet, in many ways a master, has been so close to Oriental literature. I came to this sort of thing late, but when I found out about some of the beautiful translations that have been made, it seemed to me that there was a possibility of something in myself, a possibility of poetry. And so some of the poems in this book have very long titles. I wanted to get away from a certain academic formalism and try to bring the poem closer to its real occasion. There have been some parodies of these long titles, but be that as it may. This poem is called, "As I Step Over a Puddle at the End of Winter, I Think of an Ancient Chinese Governor." And I should explain that I was thinking of a specific person. This is the great poet from the Tang Dynasty, Fa Chui. He was a government official, like several other considerable poets of his time. Tu Fu, for example, was imperial censor for a while. It sounds a little improbable to us when we think of the the knaves and fools who have been ostensibly governing us for all the way back through living memory in this country. But it isn't so crazy. Maybe it would be a good idea to have a poet be imperial censor so that, I don't know, maybe it would be a bad idea. Maybe if he were a fastidious poet, he might he might deprive us of some of the most wonderfully poetic statements of our time that perhaps would lose their poetic force if they lost their crudeness. Statements like, "I don't trust no man till I got his pecker in my pocket," you know, that, and all the that we have from our leader. Oh, that's a mild one. That's a mild one. Well, Fa Chui was a public official, and no. Before I go on with my own poem, let me talk just one moment about him. I think he's a splendid man. He's very sad and he's very funny. He has, to me, sad and funny at the same time. During one change of administration, he was told by a government associate that he had two choices open to him. He could either stay in the city of Chang'an and perhaps get murdered, or if he were able to get to a certain boat by a certain time, then meet the boat, go up the river, and he could become governor of Chungshou, which is a fair choice, political life being what it is. He got there to meet the boat, and he had done everything humanly possible to get there. He was even early, but the wind was blowing in the wrong direction, and he had to wait there for 10 days. He has this little poem of white billows and huge waves block the river crossing. Wherever I go, danger and difficulty. Whatever I do, failure. Just as in my worldly career, I wander and lose the road, so when I come to the river crossing, I am blocked by contrary winds. Of fishes and prawns, sodden in the rain, the smell fills my nostrils. With the sting of insects that come with the fog, my whole body is sore. I am growing old, time flies past, and my short span of life runs out. While I sit in a boat at Chukou, wasting 10 days. That came awfully close to somehow to my feeling about America. It'd be like you get stuck in a in a bus station in Wapakoneta, Ohio, the county seat of Uglays County, or Stumptown, Iowa, or Cream, Pennsylvania. Did you realize that there is a little section of Pennsylvania around Lancaster, and that there are towns that have titles or names like Intercourse, Pennsylvania, Blue Ball, and Cream, Pennsylvania. Why don't we get this into our poetry? It is very strange. Well, I was thinking about Pachui, and I knew how he felt. Although I'm not an ancient Chinese governor, I have from time to time done my best and got to a certain place by a certain time and found simply the wind was blowing in the wrong direction. So I was stepping over as I step over a puddle at the end of winter, I think of an ancient Chinese governor. A little epigraph to this poem is from another poem of Bachui, in which he says, "And how can I, born in evil days and fresh from failure, ask a kindness of fate?" Bachui, bawling old politician, what's the use? I think of you uneasily entering the gorges of the Yangtze when you were being towed up the rapids toward some political job or other in the city of Chungshou. You made it, I guess, by dark. But it is 1960, it is almost spring again, and the tall rocks of Minneapolis build me my own black twilight of bamboo ropes and waters. Where is Yuan Chen, the friend you loved? Where is the sea that once solved the whole loneliness of the Midwest? Where is Minneapolis? I can see nothing but the great terrible oak tree darkening with winter. Did you find the city of isolated men beyond mountains? Or have you been holding the end of a frayed rope for 1,000 years? Next, a little poem called Autumn Begins in Martins Ferry, Ohio. Now, I don't know how much sense this will make, I mean, to you right here, but in this little place in Ohio where I grew up, football was very big. There are many reasons for that, I think. It was along the Ohio River in southern Ohio, and there are many rural areas right around this vicinity, but right along the river there were many factories. Now, if factories are put up in a place where there's coal, there was coal there to fuel the factories in one way or another, and there was water power. So naturally, if you have coal and water power and electricity and factories, it becomes something else becomes necessary. It isn't perhaps man's place in nature that it is discovered then. It's the place of Greeks, Hungarians, Negroes, all sorts of other people who necessarily appear. Many poor people came from Europe along that Ohio Valley to work. And they had children, as the lower classes have been known to do from time to time. And some of those boys became good football players. Why is that? One reason, I suppose, was to be able to get out of that hole. And many of them did. Lou Groza, who was in my high school, is now the world's greatest place kicker. Well, maybe that's not such a great thing to do from the viewpoint of eternity, but he did get out. He made it all the way to Cleveland. Well, back there, this was an intense experience. Every autumn, everyone would go back to school, and there were good football teams in that whole Ohio Valley. And sometimes the football games themselves became so intense. I came to realize afterward there was some kind of dark, strange thing going on. I don't know quite what. It's very touching. It has to do with, I suppose the poem is a kind of a football fight song. And you remember the football fight songs, or if you went to high school, a place where the people played football, and where they would sing, "Hurrah for John Jones Junior High. It's the best junior high in Toledo. Its colors are purple and white, boom, boom. Purple is for valor and white is for fight, fight, fight. Hurrah for John Jones." Well, we were all young. Okay. We didn't ask to be born either, and we were all kids, 15 years old. Autumn begins in Martins Ferry, Ohio. In the Shreve High football stadium, I think of Pollocks nursing long beers in Tiltonsville and gray faces of Negroes in the blast furnace at Benwood and the ruptured night watchman of Wheeling Steel dreaming of heroes. All the proud fathers are ashamed to go home. Their women cluck like starved pullets dying for love. Therefore, their sons grow suicidally beautiful at the beginning of October and gallop terribly against each other's bodies. Here is a little poem. It's another of those sort of Chinese-like poems. At least it tried to do this. It has a long title. For some reason, this little poem has made some British reviewers and critics angry. They've got really infuriated about this. And that was strange. I still don't quite understand why they would get so angry, except that, well, the poem undoubtedly doesn't come off. At least it doesn't fulfill the intention I had for it. I meant it to be a description. I felt I wanted to get away from one kind of rhetorical clutter. Maybe one is always caught in a rhetorical clutter. Maybe we're damned to this. We've got to try to use language accurately one way or another. And occasionally we have the delusion that all we need to do is simply dispense with all orderly processes of language and simply whine at one another. But, this is true, and sometimes we can convey meanings and feelings this way. There are side effects. Maybe it's too much to give up, the beautiful rhetoric. Well, I wanted to turn away from any formal rhetoric I knew about and try to write some descriptions. Really try to describe something. Not only some objects that I saw, but some ways that I felt. And this poem is a descriptive poem. And it made some people in England angry. It seems to me inoffensive. It's called "Lying in a Hammock at William Duffy's Farm in Pine Island, Minnesota." Over my head I see the bronze butterfly asleep on the black trunk, blowing like a leaf in green shadow. Down the ravine behind the empty house, the cowbells follow one another into the distances of the afternoon. To my right, in a field of sunlight between two pines, the droppings of last year's horses blaze up into golden stones. I lean back as the evening darkens and comes on. A chicken hawk floats over, looking for home. I have wasted my life. I think what bothered those Englishmen is they were saying, "What do you mean?" And I would like to answer, "Why aren't you Jack Dempsey, you know, or something? What do you mean? Is that a real poem, or did you just make it up?" Now two hairs past a quart of milk. I took my watch off there. I look at my... This little poem is called Stages on a Journey Westward. Now, that's all it is. It's a little poem in four parts. And I think I'll indicate the parts by number. I think that makes some kind of sense. It doesn't always make sense to do that sort of thing. You know, to say, well, now we've had the first stanza, now we're going to have the second stanza. No, but I think to indicate by number will show that there are sort of four pictures. Stages on a journey westward. I began in Ohio. I still dream of home. Near Mansfield, enormous Dobbins enter dark barns in autumn, where they can be lazy, where they can munch little apples, or sleep long. But by night now, in the bread lines, my father prowls. I cannot find him. So far off, 1,500 miles or so away, and yet I can hardly sleep. In a blue rag, the old man limps to my bed, leading a blind horse of gentleness. In 1932, grimy with machinery, he sang me a lullaby of a goose girl. Outside the house, the slag heaps waited. Two. In western Minnesota, just now, I slept again. In my dream, I crouched over a fire. The only human beings between me and the Pacific Ocean were old Indians who wanted to kill me. They squat and stare for hours into small fires far off in the mountains. The blades of their hatchets are dirty with the grease of huge, silent buffaloes. Three. It is dawn. I am shivering, even beneath a huge eiderdown. I came in last night, drunk, and left the oil stove cold. Snow howls all around me out of the abandoned prairies. It sounds like the voices of bums and gamblers rattling through the bare 19th century whorehouses in Nevada. Four. Defeated for re-election, the half-educated sheriff of Mukilteo, Washington, has been drinking again. He leads me up the cliff, tottering. Both drunk, we stand among the graves. Miners paused here on the way up to Alaska. Angry, they spaded their broken women's bodies into ditches of crabgrass. I lie down between tombstones. At the bottom of the cliff, America is over and done with. America plunged into the dark furrows of the sea again. I think I would like to read my patriotic poem. One of my favorite American presidents is Warren G. Harding. Warren G. Harding is a much more interesting man. He's a much more interesting man, a much more interesting phenomenon in modern American history, I suppose in all American history, than we might think. At the moment, we remember he was a not especially good president, and he got mixed up with some people who realized that he didn't have any great intelligence. Certainly, he had no political shrewdness. He wasn't terribly bright. He got mixed up with a woman back in Marion, Ohio. He did, after all, have a love affair. His wife gave him a hard time, but he had a love affair with a woman. And do you realize that some of his poems survive? They're very bad. All right. Well, now consider the fact that, not the fact, but the idea anyway. Edmund Burke once said something very wise, I think. He said many wise things, but he said, to make us love our country ought to be lovely. Now, maybe that isn't enough, but to be led by someone who is ugly, and who is ugly, somehow is to be led into disturbance of some kind. It isn't only the great skill that people have, but they ought to have a certain beauty if they're going to lead us. And Harding, it's interesting, he wasn't very bright. He was one of the Main Street crowd. You know, they play poker on Saturday night, and they have have dinner with their wives, and then all of them get together, and the wives go into one room and chatter together about the Ladies' Aid Society, and the men go into the dining room for brandy and cigars, and they tell dirty jokes and snicker. And then they become deacons in the First Christian Church on Sunday morning. It's that world, which is a more troubling and painful world than we sometimes realize when we're making fun of them. Harding died while he was in office. I don't suppose it's been really established whether he killed himself or not, but I know that he did find out that his friends, people he thought were his friends, had been laughing at him behind his back. And as Mencken would say, they all went to Washington with him there from Ohio, and they got their front hooves into the trough. But he was a beautiful man. I mean, he looked the way a president ought to look. You know, the story is this curious human thing. Nietzsche has a little story. Maybe it's apocryphal, but it contains an idea. Somebody came up to Socrates, someone visiting Athens, and said, are you Socrates? Yes. And you know, Socrates was not very pretty. And the man said, are you the teacher about the good, the beautiful, and the true? Yes. What else? And the stranger said, well, how can this be? Because I see on your face all the wickedness and the corruption and the ugliness of which man is capable. And Socrates said, you know me, friend. You know me, friend. These are two poems about President Harding. And one of them is, I suppose, an elegy, and the other is a sort of song. The first one is called His Death. In Marion, the honey locust trees are falling. Everybody in town remembers the white hare, the campaign of a lost summer, the front porch open to the public, and the vaguely stunned smile of a lucky man. Neighbor, I want to be helpful, he said once. Later, you think I'm honest, don't you? Weeping drunk. I am drunk this evening in 1961. In a jag for my countrymen who died of crab meat on the way back from Alaska. Everyone knows that joke. How many honey locusts have fallen, pitched root long into the open graves of strip mines since the First World War ended, and Wilson, the gaunt deacon, jogged sullenly into silence? Tonight, the cancerous ghosts of old con men shed their leaves for a proud man lost between the turnpike near Cleveland and the chiropractor's signs looming among dead mulberry trees. There is no place left to go but home. Warren lacks mentality, one of his friends said. Yet he was beautiful. He was the snowfall turned to white stallion, standing still under dark elm trees. He died in public. He claimed the secret right to be ashamed. The second one is called His Tomb in Ohio, and its epigraph is from H.L. Mencken's obituary notice on William Jennings Bryan. Bryan died after the so-called monkey trial, the Scopes trial in Dayton, Tennessee. And Mencken hated Bryan. And everyone had made fun of Bryan. Perhaps he ate too much in hot weather, Mencken claimed. He didn't die of a broken heart. He died of a busted gut. When I say north of us here, I'm thinking of myself as a southern Ohioan. If you were born in Ohio, somehow all these people belong to you. You belong to them. It's a strange place. 100 slag piles north... No, I should explain one more thing. You need to know this historical fact. You see, when Harding died, the scandals that were to break out hadn't really broken out. In the misuse of government funds and log rolling and all sorts of corruption going on in the government. And Calvin Coolidge was his vice president, and Coolidge became president then, of course. Coolidge, in many ways, was a political genius and a fascinating man. And Harding died, and then the scandals broke out, and there was a problem about dedicating Harding's tomb. Well, Coolidge never did this, and finally, Coolidge didn't run in 1928, and then he and Herbert Hoover, Calvin Coolidge and Herbert Hoover, went back to Marion, Ohio, and had a dedicatory ceremony at Warren G. Harding's tomb in the rain. What a strange country, strange place. 100 slag piles north of us, at the mercy of the moon and rain, he lies in his ridiculous tomb, our fellow citizen. No, I have never seen that place where many shadows of faceless thieves chuckle and stumble and embrace on beer cans, stogie butts, and graves. One holiday, one rainy week, after the country fell apart, Hoover and Coolidge came to speak and snivel about his broken heart. His grave, a huge absurdity, embarrassed cops and visitors. Hoover and Coolidge crept away by night, and women closed their doors. Now junkmen call their children in before they catch their death of cold. Young lovers let the moon begin its quick spring, and the day grows old. The mean one-legger who rakes up leaves has chased the loafers out of the park. Minigan Leonard half believes in God, and the pool room goes dark. America goes on, laughing, and Harding was a fool. Even his big pretentious stone lays him bare to ridicule. I know it, but don't look at me. By God, I didn't start this mess. Whatever moon and rain may be, the hearts of men are merciless. Now, one more little poem here, a descriptive poem. Again, just a description. It's about horses. Just off the highway, it's called A Blessing. Just off the highway to Rochester, Minnesota, twilight bounds softly forth on the grass, and the eyes of those two Indian ponies darken with kindness. They have come gladly out of the willows to welcome my friend and me. We step over the barbed wire into the pasture where they have been grazing all day alone. They ripple tensely. They can hardly contain their happiness that we have come. They bow shyly as wet swans. They love each other. There is no loneliness like theirs. At home once more, they begin munching the young tufts of spring in the darkness. I would like to hold the slenderer one in my arms, for she has walked over to me and nuzzled my left hand. She is black and white. Her mane falls wild on her forehead, and the light breeze moves me to caress her long ear that is delicate as the skin over a girl's wrist. Suddenly I realize that if I stepped out of my body, I would break into blossom. Here's the first poem from my new book. Perhaps I should explain that this is kind of a skinny book, and it touches on many different places in America, but its main impulse is it deals with rivers, but not just it's not just a listing of rivers' names. It contains many other things. There are all sorts of rivers, and the title of the book is Shall We Gather at the River, that old hymn, if you've heard that. The first poem in the book, I think, is a kind of curse. It's a malediction. So along with the rivers, there are some poems about different cities that I've lived in. Perhaps I should say about different cities that I've died in. I didn't know more precise curse I could offer in the title of this poem than the title I found. It's called the Minneapolis Poem. I lived there for several years, and I died in Altoona, Pennsylvania. The Minneapolis Poem. I think the poem was really occasioned by the tearing down of the Skid Road near the Great Northern Railway Station all the way over to the river. The city fathers tore down the whole huge Skid Road, and they put in parking lots and a new insurance building. It seemed wonderful to me that it never occurred to them, no matter what political persuasion of different people on the city council, it never even occurred to them that all the people, thousands of people who lived in that Skid Road, were going to go on living somewhere. The assumption, evidently, was that if you tore down all the old, horrible old buildings and put in a parking lot in an insurance building designed by somebody they'd bought from Turkey or something, all the people would just, you know, vanish. They don't. They moved over to Nicollet Avenue, and as far as I know, they're still sinking down through the alimentary canal of Minneapolis toward the sea. The Minneapolis Poem. I wonder how many old men last winter, hungry and frightened by namelessness, prowled the Mississippi shore, lashed blind by the wind, dreaming of suicide in the river. The police remove their cadavers by daybreak and turn them in somewhere. Where? How does the city keep lists of its fathers who have no names? By Nicollet Island, I gaze down at the dark water, so beautifully slow and I wish my brothers good luck and a warm grave. The Chippewa young men stab one another, shrieking, "Jesus Christ!" Split-lipped homosexuals limp in terror of assault. High school backfields search under benches near the post office. Their faces are the rich, raw bacon without eyes. The Walker Art Center crowd stare at one another, and the Guthrie Theater crowd stare at the Guthrie Theater. Tall Negro girls from Chicago listen to light songs. They know when the supposed patron is a plain clothesman. A cop's palm is a roach dangling down the scorched fangs of a light bulb. The soul of a cop's eyes is an eternity of Sunday daybreak in the suburbs of Juarez, Mexico. The legless beggars are gone, carried away by white birds. The artificial limbs exchange is gutted and sown with lime. The whalebone crutches and hand-me-down trusses huddle together, dreaming in a desolation of dry groins. I think of poor men astonished to waken, exposed in broad daylight by the blade of a strange plow. All over the walls of comb cells, automobiles, perfumed and blindered, consent with a mutter of high good humor to take their two naps a day. Without sound, windows glide back into dusk. The sockets of 1,000 blind bee graves, tier upon tier, tower not quite toppling. There are men in this city who labor dawn after dawn to sell me my death. But I could not bear to allow my poor brother, my body, to die in Minneapolis. The old man, Walt Whitman, our countryman, is now in America, our country, dead. But he was not buried in Minneapolis, at least, and no more may I be, please God. I want to be lifted up by some great white bird, unknown to the police, and soar for 1,000 miles, and be carefully hidden, modest and golden, as one last corn grain, stored with the secrets of the wheat and the mysterious lives of the unnamed poor. A couple more of these. I'll just read as I come to them. This is my pokey poem. You know, it used to be that everybody... you're all too young to remember this, but back in the 50s, the 50s was a strange time in American life. It's as if everyone were in a state of suspended animation. And this was true in our political life, but in the writing that was going on, there were certain kind of poems that were they seemed to be pre-written, pre-composed, pre-digested, or something. You would get your Fulbright to Italy poem. There was the zoo poem. But now here's a new genre. This is the pokey poem. All sorts of people are genuinely square, are having the experience of getting into jail for a little bit. Well, in my time, I've been in jail, although not recently. And in jail is has been for centuries an occasion for poetry. You know, the wonderful things you'll find on the walls are not the same things you find simply on the walls of public cans. The wall of a jail is something else. And I've been there, not under very dignified circumstances. I wasn't there standing up for civil rights or anything. I was there. I was there. Inscription for the tank. My life was never so precious to me as now. I gape unbelieving at those two lines of my words, caught and frisked naked. If they loomed secret and dim on the wall of the drunk tank, scraped there by a raw fingernail in the trickling crusts of gray mold, surely the plainest thug who read them would cluck with the ancient pity. Men have a right to thank God for their loneliness. The walls are hysterical with their dank messages. But the last hophead is gone with the quick of his name, bleeding away down a new wall, blank as his nails. I wish I had walked outside to wade in the sea, drowsing and soothed. I wish I had copied some words from Isaiah, Kabir, Ansari, Whitman, anyone. But I wrote down mine, and now I must read them forever, even when the wings in my shoulders cringe up at the cold's fangs, as now. Of all my lives, the one most secret to me, folded deep in a book never written, locked up in a dream of a still place, I have blurted out, I have heard weeping in secret and quick nails broken. Let the dead pray for their own dead. What is their pity to me? I think I'll read one more. This poem is called Before a Cashier's Window in a Department Store. At a certain time, I had a kind of an account there at a department store in Minneapolis, and I needed to get a check cashed one day, a small check. I had a big old green coat my father had given me. It was very worn, and I was a little behind in paying for my account, and I was broke, except for just a little money I had, and I needed the money for $20 or something. And I've never been poor, not really poor, but this one moment in my life when I got some notion of what it was like, the girl looked at me, and she called one of these guys with brush haircuts, and their faces were just close together, and my face was about a foot and a half away through the window, and they talked about me. Have you ever been looked at that way? It's no fun. A little of it goes a long way. Before a cashier's window in a department store, the beautiful cashier's white face has risen once more behind a young manager's shoulder. They whisper together and stare straight into my face. I feel like grabbing a stray child or a skinny old woman and diving into a cellar, crouching under a stone bridge, praying myself sick till the troops pass. Why should he care? He goes. I slump deeper. In my frayed coat, I am pinned down by debt. He nods, commending my flesh to the pity of the daws of God. Am I dead? And if not, why not? For she sails there alone, looming in the heaven of the beautiful. She knows the bulldozers will scrape me up after dark behind the officers' club. Beneath her terrible blaze, my skeleton glitters out. I am the dark. I am the dark bone I was born to be. Tu Fu woke shuddering on a battlefield once in the dead of night and made out the mangled women sorting the haggard slant eyes. The moon was up. I am hungry. In two more days, it will be spring. So, this is what it feels like. Thank you.